listening to Black Hollywood Live, the world's first digital broadcast network devoted entirely to urban entertainment and pop culture. Tune in right now.
Hey, what's good, my beautiful people? It's your boy, Danny Royce. Welcome inside the Black Actors Studio. It's Thursday. We're about to make it happen here. I have an amazing guest visiting me in the studio, okay? You've seen him recently. You haven't even seen him. You've seen his work. Because this guy, you can't find him. You can find his work because it's life-changing. It's been there. You all know it. The Proud Family, Bebe's Kids, Tarzan, Emperor's New Groove. The list goes on. He's an animator, director, and Disney exec. An Oscar award-winning director for the short film. Animated short film, excuse me. Hair Love. I'm so happy to have him in the studio. Please welcome, the Black Actors Studio is very proud to have Bruce W. Smith.
Yo, wow. That's up, a crazy Bruce? Intro.
It's very well deserved.
Yo, man. I don't even stack my credits like that. That's crazy.
Very well deserved. How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. Yes, of course. It's a pleasure to have you in the studio. Like I've mentioned before, you know, you have shaped my childhood in a lot of ways.
And translation, I'm an old ass motherfucker. Okay. All right.
Hey, but it's good, though. I just want to start off by congratulating you. Oscar Award for Best Animated Short Film, Hair Love.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, amazing. And just tell us a little bit about, like, how you felt when you found that out, when you found it worn.
Oh, man. That was odd. I mean, I think, you know, I'd have to go back to when we actually sort of wrapped, like in terms of production.
Okay.
And myself, Ever Downing Jr., Matthew Cherry were sort of all kind of like scrambling to kind of get this short done. And man, it was such a road to get there because, you know, it's a short.
Yeah.
And we only had so much, you know, resources to get it done. But, you know, our production staff was cracked. You know, they were just on top of it. You know, big shout out to Karen Rupert Tolliver, Stacey Newton, Monica Young. I mean, you know, we all sort of like galvanize ourselves and make sure that we got to the finish line on time.
Yeah.
You know, to get in front of this movie Angry Birds. That was the goal. So that was our only real shot to kind of make sure that we wrapped in time to get in front of that movie because that qualified us for the Oscar run.
Gotcha.
And we felt pretty good about the movie. We felt pretty good about what we had done for sure. There's so many techniques that we were using, you know, just there's certain authenticity we were trying to carry with the hair.
Yeah.
From both characters.
Yeah.
You know, even if you look at the character design, I had to jump into the character design and make sure that those designs were animation friendly, that they could actually go through production the right way. You know, big shout out to Vashti Harrison, whose book she illustrated, Hair Love, was kind of like the visual foundation for what we had to accomplish. So once we got it done, and we started getting some early feedback, you know, got people feeling it, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that felt pretty good, but still, you know, it's like you kind of don't know, you know what I mean? And you know, what's funny is when, you know, in animation, we have these awards called the Annie Awards, which is sort of the equivalent to the Academy Awards. It's just an animation.
Right.
So you got all the categories broken down the way they break them down in the Academy Awards. But what's interesting, when it came down to nominating the shorts, like, our short wasn't nominated for an Annie Award.
Mm.
So we were kind of like, oh, you know, okay, so then let's just figure that we did some really good work we could be proud of and not necessarily try to anticipate anything other than this. We're thinking that the industry spoke.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
So then, you know, I mean, once the movie got released on YouTube, we just started getting all this love. And so now the movie is now sitting, you know, in the zeitgeist, and it's like all the people are watching, it's all the people giving this love, especially our people.
Yeah, for
because
sure.
We don't see ourselves in this sort of light, you know, from an animation standpoint, in this medium, in this way.
Yeah.
Tender Story,
yeah,
you know, executed well. So people were genuinely responding to it. And I think that started to bring some real eyeballs to it.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm.
And the people who matter in the Academy were watching this. I'm a member of the Academy, but I can only rally so many people.
Right.
But the fact that you had all these other people in the Academy really sort of watching it and rallying around it, it became sort of a talking point mm-hmm. suddenly, right at the right time. And as the season sort of progressed, our film kind of was sort of like taking that same sort of progression. And then the morning that they announced the nominees, you know, we're all sort of like, we're gathered over at Matthew's house and, mm-hmm. you know, sort of, I don't know, we don't know what to expect, you know. And certainly when the nomination came, we felt pretty good.
Of course.
Yeah. About That's our chances. Awesome. But still, man, it's like, I'm just a dude from South Central. It's like, L.A., it's like, you don't think of this, you know. Right. It's, when I first started doing animation, getting an Academy Award wasn't the goal, okay, really. Yeah. You just want to do good work.
Right.
And just be remembered for the work that you've done and just get good as an animator. Just get as good as you can possibly be. So obviously that night was just weird altogether. Yeah. I try to describe it to people. It was like, it was weird, it was cool, it was odd, you know, and then
it's all these feelings.
Really, yeah, it's all these feelings kind of like all bunched together.
Right.
And then when they announced, you know, the film, and you just kind of go crazy. And so it was a strange night, man. Wow. For sure. Strange
that's,
and cool.
That's incredible. Well, we'll get more into Hair Love and animation later on in the show. But in the beginning, we always start in the studio in the beginning. So where were you born?
Oh, man. So as I mentioned, I was born in South Central Los Angeles.
Hey.
You know what I mean?
LA native.
LA native. Like, it's rare that you meet guys like
that.
But
they're always amazing. Like, I have some LA native friends, and they're like, they're amazing people.
Yeah, people are grounded here kind of know, you know these streets. So
right.
It's like it allows you to kind of know what to expect when you're out here. Mm-hmm. Even with all the transplants, you know, it still is, you know, you kind of know everything in these streets.
Right.
So that actually helped me as I moved along, because, like, I've been drawing since I was, like, just picked up a pencil like when I was 5 years old or something like
so
that,
crazy.
Right?
That's
I actually
amazing.
Remember the first thing I actually did was my brother had a lunch pail. It's like a Batman lunch pail. And like these lunch pails, if you know anything, you're probably a little too young to know about lunch pails. You used to take out lunch in this little metal tin.
Yeah, my mom still has hers.
Okay. Well, then they had like, the tin had like a raising of an illustration. So there'd be an illustration on the front tin, but it would be raised off of the lunchbox itself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, for example, what I would do is like put a piece of paper over it mm-hmm. and just scrape on it with my pencil.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd get exactly what was on the illustrated lunch pail on a piece of paper.
Right.
And I'd be like, oh, that was cool. You know what I mean? So I would start doing that, and then I moved away from doing that and just start drawing it, you know?
Yeah.
And weirdly, it's Batman.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, it was like, I remember wearing Batman t-shirt. Like, all these pictures I would see of myself as a child, I'd be wearing this Batman t-shirt.
Wow.
Whatever it would be, like, you know, the 60s Batman.
Yeah.
The 60s Batman was just a whole different game altogether.
Different, very different.
So I always wearing a 60s Batman shirt and short pants, and always have sort of this little dish rag tied around my, you know, tied around my neck, running around Batman.
Right.
Batman all the time, right?
Wow.
So I used to draw all the time and stuff like that. And, you know, it's like, but never really had a real true outlet for it.
Mm.
So as I started to go through school, all of my teachers used to notice I used to draw all the time. I used to draw between the books and, you know, assignments, homework assignments. There would always be little drawings and dribblings of things.
Right.
And I guess they took notice of it. Now, I was just kind of like, I like doing it. It's just kind of a release. It's kind of fun. But they would set me aside.
Mm.
Like, for example, you know, when all of a sudden there's a pop quiz. In fourth grade, is a pop quiz. And it'd be like, kids are like, oh, man, dang. It's like, but Bruce, I want you to go and do this poster for us for the Dental Association. And I'm like, oh, snap.
Wow.
I was like, okay, this is cool.
Yeah.
So art gets me out of drawing.
Gets
me out of pop quizzes
right,
and stuff
right.
like that. I'm like, okay, I can use this, right?
That's
so amazing. Then I just started continuing to draw. And each teacher I went to from third to the sixth grade always found assignments for me to do, you know, whatever it would be.
That's amazing.
And so, and I used to give little drawings to my classmates. They used to like the stuff, but I kind of discarded. I just got, okay, I can do it, and it's fine, you know. But I just knew I just really loved doing it.
Right.
And it wasn't until, like, maybe my fourth grade teacher had found an art school in Hollywood.
Mm.
And in that art school, they actually had an animation program.
Wow.
And I remember it was taught by this woman who worked on a lot of animated commercials at the time. And she's kind of set us up on a basic, you know, sort of pencil to the pegboards. Here's your drawings. You draw one drawing, and you do the progression of, if you're making a character walk across the screen, You know, you put the foot out, put the walk. Mm-hmm. And now we'll shoot the drawings, and then you'll see them next week.
Right.
And that's kind of where it first was. Like, I saw these drawings move. They moved horribly. You know what I mean? It was horrible stuff. But to me, it was like, wow, I actually made a drawing move.
Made some, yeah.
You know? And from there, I just got bitten.
Wow. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember the, when I was younger, we do, like, the stick figures,
yep.
do the books, and
did
then
that.
Make a motion
thing. Yeah, did that, too. Oh, man, yeah, my mom... she used to like
go, yeah.
she had like a in our hallway at home she had a tablet that you know she'd go to work during the daytime and we were left at home locked in the house don't go nowhere take messages if people call
right
so on that message pad I did exactly that I just drew on each page my mom would come home she'd be like this boy done drew up all my messages. Now I don't know who the hell called me. Got to get this boy a drawing pad or something. So, yeah, she used to, you know,
That's
she used
awesome.
To really get on me a couple of times. I did some weird stuff when I was a kid.
I'm sure.
Like, I did this thing where there was a show called Winky Dink.
Dink.
I'm way too old for you right now, but I'm just going to drop this.
That one went.
Yeah, it went. So the idea of it was kind of like the first kind of interactive kid show, so to speak. So
it's like Blue's Clues.
Kind of like Blue's Clues, except they would encourage you to participate. Like Blue's Clues, they encourage you to read.
Yeah.
In this case here, they encourage you to, like, you know, if Winky Dink gets into any kind of crisis, you save Winky Dink, right?
Okay.
In other words, Winky Dink is being chased on a bridge. Now the bridge, there's no way to get to the other side of the mountain.
Mm.
So you have to draw a bridge, kids. Draw a bridge, and Winky Dink will run across that bridge that you draw on the TV screen. And get to the other side. I'm like, okay, let me help Winky Dink out. So sure enough, he gets this bridge, has to cross the bridge. So I break out this marker that I had and just drew right on the TV.
Oh my God.
Got Winky Dink across the bridge, exactly, right? So it's like, yeah, he got across the bridge. It was great. TV show over. That damn bridge is still on the screen, right? I'm like, now I got to scrub this damn bridge off the screen for my dad to get home.
Yeah, right?
So I scrubbed this down as much as I could. But nah, man, when my dad came home and saw the mod squad, trying to reach the mod squad, and there's a big bridge over Link's afro. It's like, who drew this damn bridge? You know, what I did know is that there was a Winky Dink drawing kit that you're supposed to lay, you know, you're supposed to buy the kit, lay the thing
over the screen gotcha.
And you draw on the Winky Dink kit.
That is so
crazy. Nobody
would
buy me no Winky Dink kit.
That name
so,
is just hilarious.
Yeah. Oh,
Winky
man,
Dink.
That was crazy.
Speaking of names, did you have any nicknames growing up?
So? Not really, but like, as I got older, so my name is Bruce Wayne Smith.
Mm-hmm. Ah, wow.
So, we were playing football in the street, I was Batman.
Yeah,
So the whole Batman prophecy kind of came full circle at that
point. That's so crazy. And then you're not really with DC.
No, not at all.
That's crazy.
Not at all.
How it just came around.
No.
So, how was the family dynamic? It seemed like you had a family that supported this this dream and this creativeness of you. Did you have, how many siblings did you have?
Oh, man. I've got like 1, 2, 3 older brothers. I'm in the middle, and I got a younger brother and a younger sister.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Yeah.
Big family.
So, I'm the one in the middle. So, you know, it's like my mom was really big on trying to find an outlet for what I was trying to do because she didn't know what.
I don't know what to do with this
could
child.
Go. Yeah. I mean, I had to figure out where it could go.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
She just knew that. And, you know, as I got through high school, I did it, but I wasn't necessarily trying to draw a whole lot of attention to it. Like, you know, I started to play sports and stuff like that. But I used to draw for guys' Letterman's jackets and stuff. You know, all my boys drawing their nicknames and all their sort of logos and stuff. I used to do all that stuff through high school. I used to, you know, I was on the journalism committee, so I always draw for the yearbooks and stuff like that. But nothing great. I wasn't voted most artistic in my high school. You know what I mean? So
really?
It wasn't like, it was just kind of on the low. People who knew.
Right.
You know, and there was one dude who was way better than me in high school. I used to envy him a bunch. What was his name? Levi. That was dude's name. Levi. He used to draw. So when I grew up, Parliament Funkadelic was like shit.
Yeah,
so, and their album covers was the bomb. Like, you know, we used to go, every time they had an album, I used to go rush the store and see what was on it.
Those album
you know
covers
what I mean?
Would
Those
be
album covers
crazy.
Were crazy.
Right.
So, and I remember that Aqua Boogie album cover was everything to me, like as a kid growing up. Like, that cover answered everything about how to draw black characters. In a very sketchy way, still cut, but loose, fun. You feel the personality of the characters. And so just hold that beat for a second. So fast forward, I finally meet my man, Overton Lloyd, who actually did those covers. Man, I'm awe in this brother. Wow. Like, this dude, like, I'm, like, in awe of his presence. I know every time I mention that to him, he's like, man, shut up. Man, stop, man. You the bomb. We just go over there and go, no, you the shit. No, you the shit. Right. No, you. Like, we just go back and forth with that because Overton, like, influenced me, period. Like, when I started to really research all the stuff that he done, all the he did these great characters for the show, Win, Lose, or Draw.
Mm.
And he used to draw right there on the TV show. He could just draw with. I was never good at that.
Wow.
And he used to knock that out. Overton was and still is the bomb. Like, finding stuff online. He's an incredible artist. He still hangs around. He's the guy who, if you ever see a George Clinton concert, he's the guy who's holding the sign, walking around. Because he draws all the signs and stuff like that. That's, you know, oh, man, his art is off the chain. And that was the first time I saw somebody draw black people that actually could resonate to me. Like, we were working on this video a long time ago for the Gap Band, and he was designing all these characters for the Gap Band, and the way he could draw Charlie Wilson, the way he could draw Bootsy Collins, the way he could draw George Clinton, like, I can't do that, you know? But it continued to, like, you know, keep my juices flowing, like,
motivate you, inspire,
There's another dude who draws black characters the way I like to see him,
right?
You know what I mean? And that was a big deal to me. So now going back to that time where I saw that, it just continued to kind of like inject me as a kid with like, I got to do this because this dude is doing it. I can do this,
right?
So
of course.
So yeah, through high school, man, and right around the time I was graduating, my mom was asking me, "What you gonna do?" And I think I want to do this cartoon thing. And she's like, "This boy gonna be a starving artist.
Yeah,
he's gonna do that, ain't he?" And then I had to find this school in Valencia, which just so happens to be the animation mecca. And it's called California Institute of the Arts. And they have an animation program that Walt Disney himself founded, you know, back in Chicago. It's called Chinards.
Chicago?
Yeah, man. And then they brought it out here in Valencia, California. And, like, you find that all the legends, you know, anybody who's everybody in animation at that time had attended that school.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
So, yeah, so you went out, you went there right after high school. This is what you were going to do.
Yeah.
You were going to focus on that. What were some of the challenges you faced, like, when you first got into there and, you know, running with the big dogs and all that stuff? Yeah.
Well, you know, I remember that was the first time I really realized that I ain't shit. like that really was the first time where I was like, ooh, man, you got to step your game up because these dudes.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, when I went to school, guys who were like, you know, who went on to direct movies like Lion King and How to Train Your Dragon, Tarzan, you know, The Emperor's New Groove, you mentioned. These directors were like my classmates. So, but they were already steps ahead of the game because they already had relationships with a lot of the Disney artists who were there at the time. And we're talking about guys who go back to the original, like, that guy was art director on, you know, Sleeping Beauty. This guy was supervising animator on Peter Pan. This guy directed those shorts, you know, the Goofy shorts, the how-to shorts, and the Donald Duck shorts. Like, these guys were like our teachers and, in most cases, mentors to some of the art. I don't know that. You know, I'm just coming. I don't know who's who. I had no. It's like stepping into the NBA and not knowing who Will Chamberlain was or whatever, or who Michael Jordan is. You know, it's like, and literally having Michael Jordan come speak to you, and you're like, who's this old crusty black dude talking about, you know, whatever you're talking about. Like that's the type of respect that I had back then. And it wasn't until this book that came out called The Disney Illusion Life, which is basically our Bible. Like, it's our sort of like, who did what, when, what they were responsible for. Because sometimes people think animation, they just think one monolithic thing.
Right.
You know, it's like, it's just, you're an animator. People don't equate to the animator being like the actor.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, the background artist being like a set designer. You know, a storyboard artist, in lots of ways, is like your director. He is your director. He is your director of photography. You know what I mean? He's watching all things as a as a storyboard artist.
And you mentioned that in one of your past interviews that, you know, the animators are actors with a pencil.
Yeah.
And can you elaborate on, like, what you mean by that?
It's exactly what it is. It's like animation just alone, that discipline, you are truly an actor. And so, for example, you know, some of my favorite films, it's the performances that resonate. Sometimes the films aren't so great. But the performances really resonate with you, right? So that's how I found out who my favorite animator was, you know? Because I look at all these films, I'm like, damn, that character look how the nuances of the character, like, he's not like this character. Hand-drawn animation has this specificity to it, yeah, where you can always point out who did what.
Right.
Because they would assign, you know, the animation that way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you take, okay, you be Captain Hook, you're Peter Pan, you know, you're Wendy, you know, you're the dog, mm-hmm, you know, you're the parents. Like, they would assign all the animators, right, these roles.
Right.
So when you look at the movie from that standpoint, you get to dissect it, and you start to understand and study performances. So you gravitate to certain characters.
Gotcha.
For me, growing up, it's like I gravitated to Captain Hook. I was like, ah, it's amazing. Performance, funny. You know, you feel it. It's dangerous. It's, mm-hmm, all those things that you need from a villain. Who did that? You find out it was mainly this guy, Frank Thomas, split between a few other animators, but really him.
Right.
And then I'm like, okay, that dude's bomb. I gotta study this guy's stuff. But who is this guy who did this movie? You know, who's the guy who did Medusa, Madame Medusa, and, like, Rescuers, which is, mm-hmm, not a great movie, but the performance of this character, this woman who's, like, you know, got a big gun, and she's shooting people, and she's driving, yeah, cars, and she's doing all great performances. She's villainous. She's, and it's like, that performance is the best performance I've probably seen, you know, in a hand-drawn animated film. Like, who is this? That's Milt Call. So, mm-hmm, I discover that, okay, Milt Call is like my Michael Jordan. He is that dude for me, right? Never met him. But he was the crusty guy who I saw when I was a freshman in college, and I'm like, and he's giving us a lecture. I'm like, man, I'm out of here. I'm done. I didn't know who he was. If I'd have known, you know, the older version of me would have slapped me and said, sit your ass down and listen to what this brother got to say. So it was finding out that and understanding the legacy of these guys' work. You start now understand how to shape your toolkit as an animator. So, and part of it is your draftsmanship capabilities, how well you can draw. Mm-hmm. So I had to shape that up because, you know, I remember, like, we started school, like, in September. By the last part of October of that, you know, like, the next month,
yeah,
my life drawing teacher told me, you know what, you ain't getting this at all. And you either going to decide right now, you're going to get this, or you're going to go home. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like that sort of old man conversation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I was like, I just got here. Like, I'm not getting this. And he's telling me, and I'm not going to have a career doing this. I didn't just hunker down and figure out how to work this out. And I started to realize the trick to my drawing skills came from moving characters around, not from just drawing something static. Like, drawing something static didn't resonate to me.
Right.
Once I moved it around, I started to understand parts and stuff and how to move parts. And, the bigger word is kinesiology.
Yeah.
And anatomy and kinesiology and understanding how movement and stuff like that works with. And so I started to really understand that. So I do that by, I was watching live action. So you take some of your favorite films and you start to stop framing these films and stepping through them and understanding how animators, how actors, real life actors, make acting choices based on what's there.
Right.
You know, if they're formulating a thought to attack somebody, stop, frame it, watch it, see how they formulate the thought, and see what happens next. You know, see what the choices make. Because the choice is never the same from a live action standpoint.
Right.
From an animation standpoint, a lot of times guys would limit it so that the choices will always be the same.
Right.
So it stagnates your performance.
Gotcha.
So you always had to sort of think a little bit differently out the box. You had to think like a real actor, a live actor, and use that application in animation. So once I started formulating all that in my head, I'm like, okay, I get this shit now. I get it.
Nice.
Yeah, I can get this. I can do this.
Awesome.
So I started drawing just like that. I just started drawing performances as opposed to just drawing things.
Right.
And it made a difference. So I started really studying after that, studying some of my favorite actors in that sense. So,
which are?
Oh, man. So Richard Pryor, for one, like just seeing him kind of, even in his stand-up, just watch how he sort of gives you, like there's a great, in his first movie, was Alive on Sunset Strip, he does the whole thing with him being a forest with a bear. And it's like, dude, I wanted to animate that. Like, I wanted to animate that, but I knew I would kill it. It would be horrible,
right,
I'm saying.
Right.
I wasn't ready for that yet. Yeah. It was just too next level, but I could see it in my head, how he's playing those moments out, and it was just hilarious. And so, so Richard Pryor's always great at sort of setting the table, but like, man, I gravitated towards actors. Like, Jack Lemmon is one of my favorite actors.
Okay.
Of all time. Like, one of my favorite films is, like, The Great Race. He plays his character, Professor Fate. And it's such a great, from an animation standpoint, such a great performance. If you can just look at him and you can see how he plays two characters in the movie.
Yeah.
So, and both characters really different. And it's just, it's fun. He reminds me of a cartoon you know, mm-hmm. when he's moving around the entire movie. Jim Carrey's like that too.
Yeah, Jim Carrey.
Oh man, Jim Carrey's amazing, man. He's like crazy. A moving animated animator. Character.
Yeah, he's
completely. I get so much joy from like just step framing through his slow-moing his performances.
Crazy.
And he's amazing. I gravitate towards actors who really kind of give this sort of elastic, real performance.
Mm-hmm.
I love George Clooney because he has these real subtle kind of like
very subtle, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. very subtle thought things that mm-hmm. he does, and then when he's doing comedy, he drops into really great expressions and has a very funny walk sometimes when he's walk cycles are funny to me. I always watch people walk.
Uh-huh.
Richard Pryor has a great walk at the end of Which Way Is Up, I think it is, where he's just walking down the middle of the road. He has this really crazy, joyous walk. Hysterical. I study things like this all the time. So
it's such an interesting, different perspective, you know, to see. But I want to say thank you again for joining me in the studio. And also, before we get into your credits, I want to say thank you so much for tuning in. If you're watching, be sure to hit like. Go ahead and comment down at the bottom if you have any questions for Bruce or myself. And also, shout out to Kevin Undergaro and Maria Menounos for allowing me to bring in these amazing guests every week for you to share their stories with you and how they got to where they are. And thank you so much. And also, if you want to check out Hold Season 1 of Inside the Black Actors Studio, be sure to visit on theonchannel.com. That's www.theonchannel.com. You can stream the entire first season there. And we are back with Bruce.
Yep.
So when you first started, I'm sure there weren't a lot of people of color, animated black animators out there. And then you even said that the guy had the conversation with you that you needed to either go home or get it together. How did that motivate you and inspire you to push forward? Because you didn't see many people like you doing what you were doing.
Yeah. Well, A, it comes from not having a plan B.
Mm.
You know what I mean? It's like, okay, this is it. You know, I spent a lot of money here, and I don't think nobody can afford it. So, you know, I got to be able to make this option work.
Right.
And yeah, you're right. You know, it's like, it's so funny because when I was at school, the year that I was a freshman was the year that they let the most black people into the program.
Mm.
So it was myself and three other black dudes, right? And we all ended up rooming together, which was, you know, listen, we brothers. So we start to the head. And I like, what's up, man? Like, you way over there. You in the school too?
Yep.
Like, all right, well, we need to get together. Like that thing, you know?
Right.
And so we kind of, it was good to have other black dudes there so we can share our experiences. I mean, like, one is from Cleveland, one from Chicago, the other's from New York. So we kind of represented, you know, a nice sort of, like, part of the nation where we had different experiences, but the same.
Right.
So, and so we gleaned off of each other, kind of leaned on each other lots of times artistically. We were all in different artistic spaces.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one could do more than the other, you know, one knew more than this, one knew more. So we tried to plug, you know, in and say, okay, you know this, I can help you with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know that. You know this part, so I can help you with this, or he can help me with that.
Right.
So we kind of plugged in like that. But we did have an instance where it was so funny because, you know, we had a class of about, you know, maybe 35 artists in our, you know, in our freshman class, four of us black. And I remember the teacher came to us once because we all kind of roomed in the same area. You know, we all had different sort of studio spaces, so to speak. And we all roomed in the same area. And I remember our teacher coming up to us saying, you know, I need to talk to you guys. You know, white guy, old white dude from back from Disney days and stuff. And he says, you four, you guys need to break this up. Like, you need to go, you know, mingle amongst, you know. And we were like, I'm like, well, how come you're not asking them to come mingle with us?
Right,
what are you saying
exactly?
So once we flipped the script on him, he's like, all right. But I'm watching you guys. You know, I was like, fuck, are you watching them too?
Right.
Like, what is that about?
Oh, my God.
So, you know, it's like the episode. Listen, we were rare in this business.
Yeah.
There wasn't anybody that we could look at the time. We were saying, that's a black dude. We need to call him up and and go kind of like find out what is the formula in this. Now, the beauty in animation is that aside, it's all artistically based. Like your level of how you can raise yourself in this game is all based on your skill set.
Because
I've seen assholes raise up in this, you know what I mean,
yeah,
in this business and actually make something of themselves, but they still assholes.
Yeah.
So it's like, I know as black folks, we can't necessarily afford that. You know, we can't afford that accommodation of being black. It's not a luxury we can actually have. No. So we can only rely on our skill set.
Right.
So I knew that right away. It's like, don't matter. It's like they respect me for what I actually can actually do.
Right.
All the respect that I'm getting from all my classmates is based on what I can do, not based on how funny I am or how whatever. It's at the end of the day, it's like, Bruce can do this. You know? Rob can do this. Chris could do this, and we all gravitated to that. So it wasn't sort of a racial divide amongst us as classmates, just the teachers, you know, the old school.
Of course, yeah.
So, so once that was put to bed, and I knew I could walk to Rob Minkoff and say, "Hey, man, help me with the shot," and he would help me with the shot, you know, openly, willingly, give up his, you know, what he knows from a skill set standpoint. It's like, "Oh, man, that's cool. Like, look how you drew that. Look how you moved that around." He'd be like, "Yeah, man. So this is what you need to do: X, X, Y, and Z." That was welcome. And so that didn't exist.
Right.
You know what I mean? But the weird thing about it is that that whole sort of colorblind thing actually sort of lent itself to my films, because I feel like when I look back on my films, and I mean, it was like, it was my responsibility to put some black characters on the screen, and I didn't. Like it wasn't like it was a conscious choice. It was just, I was just in the moment of trying to understand this craft and not aware of the responsibility of the craft.
Right.
Which is fine. It was important for me to know that what I needed to understand then. And now I can step back and recognize,
these
characters could have easily been black. You know what I mean? It's like, but I just didn't have that then.
Right.
And as I stepped into the business, that's when I started to regret it, because I knew I was just going to be working on all these projects that just really didn't have the flavor of stuff that I really wanted to
do. Well, I wanted to get into, speaking of flavor, Bebe's Kids, okay? How did that come about? I mean, I know Reggie with the, you know, stand-up, Bebe's Kids, you know, was always a bit, right?
Right.
But whose idea was it to turn it into an animation? You said they were thinking about a TV show, then it became film. And
So the initial idea, obviously, was Robin Harris, a comedian who passed.
Yeah.
Of like set the standard for, you know, what we knew as like black comedy, you know, in like the 90s, you know,
House
sort
Party,
of was in front thing. Of the explosion. Yeah, in front of that explosion. And when Reggie found him, put him in House Party, Reggie Hudlin and Warrington Hudlin, the Hudlin brothers found him, put him in House Party. I mean, that was just an amazing performance. And we hadn't seen that. And it resonated with so many people. And Robin Harris was on his way to a stellar career. And so what happened was, the Hudlin brothers were shaping that whole Bebe's Kids thing as either a live action movie or a live action TV show, one or the other, right? But they were expanding into that space. And then Robin Harris passed away suddenly and unexpectedly.
Yeah.
And so the Hudlin brothers really still wanted to do this. They felt like if we can do this in animation, we can find the right talent to galvanize around it, we can actually do something that's really cool. So, but to their surprise, as they walked around to different studios, no one knew Robin Harris, and no one knew the material. Not until they landed at Hyperion, where I was working on this project called Rover Dangerfield. That was sequence directing. And they brought it in, and that was the first time they saw a brother in a studio. And a brother in sort of a significant role.
Right.
You know, like animation at the time was sort of represented to like maybe, I'm being generous by saying 3-5% people of color.
Yeah.
You know, and then you got to dissect, break down that 3-5% of people who actually can do something.
Right.
You know what I mean? has the ability to sort of like take something and make something happen. So, so slim pickings, man. And so when I met Reggie, it was like, you know, this material, like, yeah, Robin Harris, man, I'm from LA. He played at the, that comedy club right there on Vernon and Crenshaw, whatever, right? Comedy Act Theater. They were like, okay, he knows this material. Like, he knows. So let's try to shape this together. So that's kind of where the thing started. So so we started shaping. I started, like, you know, listening to routine. I'm starting to design stuff. This is great because I'm in black folk world.
Right.
Like, and I got, you know, sort of the protection of the Hudlin brothers who just coming off a House Party.
Yeah.
We're going to make this blackity black. Right. That's who, you know, black-ity we're thinking, black. You know. And so we're designing. And I'm thinking the whole time that we're a TV show. We're designing for a TV series. And I was designing it as a TV series. You know, it's like there's certain ways that you have to sort of create stuff so it can actually move through production a certain way.
Right.
So I was designing the whole thing, designing the characters, got some guys help world building and stuff like that. And so the head of Paramount at that time was Brandon Tartikoff. And he was walking through the studio finding projects to make, you know, Paramount's getting their feet in the game of feature animation. And so they saw some things around the room, and then he saw Bebe's Kids. And he was like, well, what is this? And then we kind of did, like, you know, the elevator pitch. And he was like, well, let's make this, you know, the movie. And we were all sort of, like, aghast, mm-hmm. you know, because it just didn't seem like, you know, you're talking about who's in this arena of movies right now. Well, it's Disney.
Yeah.
Then I think maybe Don Bluth was doing some stuff. And then there was lots of soft fairy tale stuff.
Right.
So, and this is Bebe. It's kind of hardcore. What is this material exactly? Yeah, I mean, Reggie wrote it as sort of PG-13, you know, uh-huh. material. Okay, we'll just make it and figure out where it lands. And so the most interesting thing about working on Bebe's Kids was how a lot of artists didn't understand it. Now, I never really had, if I'm working at a studio, I never had the luxury of like, hey, you know, I don't really want to work on that project because maybe it's a little too scary white for me. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's like, it's not just white, it's scary white. Like, let me back away from this.
Right.
Like, you wouldn't hear that out of my mouth. Like, what's scary white? What is that exactly, right? I'm working on projects. I just want to craft. Yeah, I want to work on something that's cool. Work on my skills. I want to work.
Right.
You know what I mean? You want to get paid. So, so I had artists, and mind you, these were artists who were just kind of middling artists anyway. Mm-hmm. But even the fact that they were middling artists, there was better artists who got it, understood it, worked on the project, and it was great. But the middling artists were like, I don't know what this project is, and I don't know if I want to work on this because I think those kids are throwing up gang signs, and I don't know these characters. It's kind of crazy. So I'm backing out of this project. Like, and I'm hearing this from, you know, one of the producers, and so-and-so is working on a project now. He's not. I'm like, well, why not? Yeah, because he thinks, well, you think he's going to get jumped at night? Like, he thinks he'll walk out of the studio here and somebody goes, hey, you working on that Bebe's Kids?
Right.
You know, pop, pop. You know what I mean? It's like, dude, it's not that. Yeah, you know, it's not that at all. So, but I never thought that artists would actually sort of think of it that way.
Yeah. Right?
Like, they actually had that choice. So you had people just didn't quite understand the material.
Right. Which, I mean, sure, some audience didn't either, but I mean, it's such a classic.
It speaks in a different lane. It just speaks specifically to us.
Right, exactly.
So that's fine. It sits as its cult status. You got to understand, too, there was a lot of things that were mashing together at that time. You're talking about hip-hop was really sort of finding its voice at that time.
Right.
And then you had the riots.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like we were making that movie in the middle of the riots.
Yeah, it was crazy.
So it was like the whole... The temperature of everything, you know, when you talk about making a movie, you never know what's going to happen in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that could affect your movie.
For sure.
So, that was, you know, it was a fun project. It led us, because you got to think about also the last time you had actually seen African-American characters on the screen. I'm talking about on the big screen.
Mm-hmm.
How far back do you have to go? You're talking about, so from 1992, I can't think of any black characters, a movie with black, you know, black antagonists and protagonists on the screen, you got to go way back to what?
Yes.
I don't even know. You don't want to say Song of the South. You're trying not to.
You were saying, yeah, I was going to say.
I was like, I don't really know. So it was a first of its kind in many ways.
Right.
And it did what it needed to do.
Yeah.
Because, you know, for me, it was like, it made it okay for everybody to see black characters on the screen, you know, because there was that sort of like, what do we do? Is his lips too big? Is the eyes too big? Is it so-and-so? Is this
right.
and that? Are they speaking wrong? Is all these myths are now getting pushed aside. So
stereotypes.
Yeah, all the stereotypes and all of that stuff, because you had a range of black characters that are helping to tell the story, not just one.
Right, right.
And that matters in trying to set up a project that you feel like at least can kind of kick the doors open a bit.
Yeah. And speaking of first of its kind, The Proud Family, which, man, I love The Proud Family. But that's just incredible, just seeing a black family on screen, animated black family on screen. I think pretty much all we had before that was Susie Carmichael on Rugrats, and we saw her family like every now and then, maybe like once a season. But tell us a little bit about how that formulated, and then getting the certain stars like Tommy Davis and Kyla Pratt and all that, like getting them on board. How was that?
Well, one of the things I learned from Bebe's Kids was that you make something, if people hear that you're making something that kind of like is running down a certain lane, people will come and support that. When we were making Bebe's Kids, Reggie and I were amazed at the phone calls we were getting from people in our casting sessions saying they want to come and do this.
Right.
And it was like, wow, so-and-so just said they want to come and do this. Like, can you believe that? Mm-hmm. This is crazy, right? But we knew that there was something. There was something in that that people felt like, hey, we jumping in this medium? We want to be a part of this medium too, type mm-hmm. of thing, right? It's the same thing we experienced on Hair Love. Hair Love, when it went as a Kickstarter, people were like, you guys doing this as a Kickstarter?
Yeah.
Who were the executive producers on that? Game. Like, everybody who was Jordan Peele, yeah. Gabrielle yeah. Union, Dwayne Wade. People want content that they feel speaks to them
yeah.
and can speak to their kids.
Yeah.
We just don't, no one's really kind of allowed us to participate in this meeting.
Right.
That's what we learned from Bay Bay's kids. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you take that into, say, the Proud Family. So the first time I started crafting the idea of the Proud Family was because of, I had kids, Rugrats was on.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, yeah, like you saying, you nailed it. You see Susie Carmichael every once in a while.
Right.
Right. And I was like, okay, well then, why? And then at the time also, we had like, you know, the animated sitcom, mm-hmm. The Simpsons were on.
The Simpsons, yeah.
You
yeah.
know, Family Guy.
Yeah.
American Dad, after the short version was. And then it was like The Critic and a couple other animated sitcoms, things that kind of came and go. But yet and still, there was the animated sitcom that was there. Mm-hmm. And it's popular,
right?
So, and no one was still sort of, you know, adding any characters of color to the mix. So I was like, okay, well then how come I can't do that? So right at the end of this movie I did called Space Jam, I started creating just the seeds of what it could be. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Oscar and Trudy and BB and CeCe was kind of like the beginnings. The first drawing I ever did on the Proud Family, I think it was BB, mm-hmm. like with his big afro, and he had a doll. He used to do this as a kid, take the heads off of dolls and stuff. You yeah. know, dolls just disintegrate. He's holding his doll. That's funny. So, excuse me. So, mm-hmm. so I'm like, okay, let's start here, because I think that, you know, at least I could take something like this to you know, a competing network of Nickelodeon and say, hey, you don't want your version of Rugrats? I got these characters here. So then I just started forming all these characters and writing little bits of who I think these characters are, forming it, thinking about the world. Yeah, it's going to be sort of L.A.-ish.
Mm-hmm.
La Cienega Boulevard is. So I started
crazy.
Forming all this stuff. And then, you know, like took all my toys, you know. And the first place I landed actually was an early version of Disney television animation. Like, so back in the day, you know, they were doing stuff, but it wasn't the Disney TV regime.
That's now.
Mm-hmm. And I remember, and this was what I was going to be met with along the way, was like, oh, yeah, these are cute. I get this. I like these characters. I like this funny mother and father, funny characters. But we don't do that type of stuff here. Mm. You might go to, like, maybe BET. Or, you know, UPN, I think, maybe. You could probably do something like this. I'm like, wow, that's crazy. Like, really? Like, okay. And I kind of laughed because that was kind of like I expected that, you know, because they just didn't have the understanding of maybe is something that you guys probably need, you know?
Yeah.
So literally then just took it to Nickelodeon. And Nickelodeon was like, oh, this is fantastic. We'll do this. And so what happened from there was we did the pilot with Nickelodeon and the Disney Channel, which was very different from Disney TV.
Oh, yeah.
The Disney Channel, when we did the pilot, you know, here's the thing. Again, it's like Nickelodeon's testing the pilot all over the place. Now, if you know L.A., they're testing the pilot places like Chatsworth, you know, Canoga Park, you know, yeah. It's like Calabasas,
oh, God.
You know, and people are like watching it, not knowing exactly how these black dynamics are working,
yeah,
you know, and so they were wondering what they should do with it. It's well produced, it's fun, these are fun characters, we've never seen this before, but like people aren't resonating to mm-hmm. it the way we expect them to. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, because you guys should test this in Compton.
Yeah.
Test it in South Central. Go right. test it in some place in Chicago. Like, you guys are testing the wrong areas.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like at that time, we rely heavily on the Nielsen ratings. I explained earlier, it's like, mm-hmm. and I don't know no black Nielsen family.
Right.
I don't know Nielsen Jackson.
Right, yeah. Nielsen Johnson.
Yeah, yeah. Take it to Nielsen Jackson. He'll like it. His whole family pressed that button. So it was like, what do you do with this? The whole time I didn't know that the Disney Channel was kind of like, they were following all of these.
They were. They just didn't want to be the first.
They were shadowing.
They were shadowing.
And so they looking. And so I get a call one day from a Disney Channel exec telling me, hey, listen, what is Nickelodeon doing with that Proud Family? We've seen it. We think it's pretty cool. And so I said, I don't know. We have an option coming up. You know, he says, well, that option come, why don't you just bring it over here to us? Mm-hmm. And so we literally walked it across the street to Disney once we got out of our option with Nickelodeon, with the Disney Channel, and you know. Mm-hmm. And then, then the sweet spot was, okay, Disney Channel was like, all right, listen, we like the idea of the show. How do you want to do it? I want to do it like a sitcom. I want to do it like a regular animated sitcom. Like, right. Okay, well, who do you want in mind and run the show? And I was like, there's this guy, Ralph Farquhar. I don't know him personally, but, you know, I mean, I love his work. You know, I love his Moesha. And I was like, they're like, well, you can get Ralph. You can do the series. And it, that's kind of how I went to Ralph. And I was like, hey, Ralph. Yeah, man. So I got this thing here. Ralph, what did Ralph say? Ralph said, hey, man, you just brought me off the golf course, so this better be good.
Hey, the best deals are made on the golf course.
I know, right? I was like, so I'm like, okay, so let me tell you what it is. And I just kind of showed him the pilot, broke down the characters to him. He's like, oh, I get this. I'm going to do this.
Awesome.
So Ralph came on board, man, and it was that was what really set the template for everything from there. Yeah.
Right, so I hear I hear that it might be a potential reboot of The Proud Family in the future.
Oh, I'm sorry, I was drinking. What did you just say? They're rebooting The Proud Family? I have not heard that at all.
I don't know. It's just a little birdie told
me. That's wild news, man. Wow. You know, it would be fantastic did do that.
It would be.
It would be fantastic if they did do that and the whole cast came back.
And the whole cast. That would be amazing.
Yo, that would be wild, wouldn't it?
That would be just living my life.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my God.
My best life.
Dude, I'd be in front of TV every day watching that.
Because, I mean, there's nothing on right now. Like, ever since it left, there's nothing on. Like,
you know what's so funny about that? I'm glad you said that, because when Ralph and I always have discussions about this, and we're like, you know what's so funny about it? When we did the show, and now with social media and everything, you sort of really get people kind of revisiting their childhood and everything.
Yep.
And you just get, you know, as soon as people hear about The Proud Family, it's like Black Twitter lights up like crazy.
Yeah.
You just get this crazy, you know, these flames, these sparks coming out. And Ralph and I say, it's just amazing that nobody came behind us, you know, and actually sort of like it was the lead for anybody else from a creative standpoint to come up and step up and kind of do this. And then, you know, you had the Boondocks. It's a different show, which is great.
Different,
But, like, there's nothing else that's sitting there that would actually sort of feed this audience. Mm-mm. So, yeah, we both feel like it would be the perfect show for today, the way we could do it today.
Oh, yeah.
The type of stories we could tell.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, people alone, you know, if we were to do it again, people don't even want us to change the theme song.
No, definitely don't. Right? Don't change the theme song.
What do you do about that?
My only thing with, like, would they be older? Would the characters be older?
Right, you know? Yeah. You know what I mean? I know. I'm thinking about that, too. I'm like, wow, if I were to do that today, would we age it up older?
Would Penny be a little...
Would she be a little older? Oh, these are really great questions.
Going to college or something? Yeah, we'll have to stay
tuned. These are really great questions, man. Yes. I think you've got a lot of people out there talking now.
Oh, yeah. Let us know your thoughts, those who are watching, and what you'd like to see in case it does get rebooted. Who knows?
Man, that's a spit take. I almost had to spit out my
head, man. Wow. So I want to, before we get into our special segment, I just want to touch on Hair Love one more time, working with Issa. And, like, did you have her in mind when it came to the voice, or who was it?
When we were first talking about the idea of, like, there's only one character that's going to be speaking, which is the mom, and Matthew, I think, always felt like we had a list. It was a small list, but Matthew had a relationship with Issa, and I thought Issa was a great choice because, again, it's a voice that you never really heard in this medium before. Mm-hmm. And see, that's the great thing about black talent. They're not being in this medium.
Yeah.
Every voice seems fresh.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? It's like, I've never heard that voice before. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, that character suddenly becomes that much more real.
Right.
So, and, you know, all the other studios, they don't necessarily... What other studios do when they're creating their films and such... And they're trying to inject black talent, so to speak. They always go to the well of the most popular black talent.
Of course.
So what happens is that character's in almost every show, right, or every movie. And so the character that you created visually for the screen, the character that you have voicing in is outshining the character that actually is on the screen.
Right.
So you're already thinking about who this character is because the voice is too dynamic.
Mm.
The key to even when we were casting Proud Family was exactly that. It was like we had people come to us once they knew that they were, you know, that we were doing this type of show. And I was really weeding through trying to find the right voices. Tommy was great because Tommy is such a funny, hilarious comedian.
So funny.
That he could paint this Oscar character exactly. This Oscar character is just the biggest buffoon,
of course.
You know, ever.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's got heart to him. Uh-huh. So Tommy knew exactly who his character was, and he can jump into the skin of this. And it's not Tommy.
Uh-huh.
It's Oscar Proud.
Right.
You see what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
And Kyla is... You know, now Kyla is she's so seasoned.
Yeah.
She jumps right into Penny Proud.
Yeah.
We were doing the show the first time around. She was great, just an innocent 14-year-old, and that's the voice that we wanted.
Right.
And it was a voice you hadn't heard, but you feel that voice.
Yeah.
She feels there's a tinge of ghetto in there. You know what I mean? But it's a real sincere black girl.
Right.
Like, these are things that I was going for the whole time. Sugar Mama, Jo Marie Payton.
Sugar, yeah.
You know, it was like
so funny.
Yeah, she knew the character as soon as she jumped in. Uh-huh. I know this character. And then I just needed some really solid sincere, sweet performance, and Paula J. Parker was fantastic for that.
For sure.
And you hadn't... Who else is going to find Paula J. and put her in an animated movie?
Yeah.
Like, you see what I mean? So
right.
So we had to make sure that we cast from a very sincere perspective.
Gotcha.
And it just made the characters really sort of resonate and feel good.
Right.
You know, you had to feel these characters.
Yeah.
And then when we got Cedric the Entertainer for Bobby Proud, like, nobody knew that was Cedric.
No.
You know what I mean?
I didn't at first.
See what I'm saying? So it's like, and Cedric is like, you know, comedians make great voices because they can give you the crazy, sincere performance and still be funny.
Of course.
As hell at the same time. And what's so funny is that Disney, I don't think, when we were doing the show, they were like, you know, we love the family. Minimize Bobby.
Mm.
You know, because no one really understood Bobby. Big afro, Earth, Wind & Fire outfit from the 70s, you know, they didn't understand how to put these. Just speaking like, you know,
right.
Lionel Richie meets Sugarfoot from Hot Players meets Michael Cooper from Confunction. They didn't understand that vibe. I can't explain that to a white executive. He's Michael Cooper from Confunction.
Like what?
He's Lionel Richie, but not Lionel Richie. Lionel Richie from the Commodore. Lionel Richie. Like it's a different Lionel Richie.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He's Maurice White, Earth, Wind & Fire. You don't understand.
No.
You don't understand. I'm not still not getting you. That's what I'm doing.
That would have been a pointless conversation.
No, like, really? Nah, I'm not following this. Okay, you just got to listen.
Right.
So once Cedric like laced up those headphones, man, and jumped into the character, he was amazing.
Right.
And he was our character that actually Disney wanted to push aside, but he got the NAACP award
right.
for that character.
Yeah, brilliant.
So it's like, you know, those guys are brilliant. It's like, I'm stupid. Like, I was going for the stupid stuff. And these guys really sort of laid the performances in that really made it work really well. And I think across the board, you know, when Ralph and I were talking about casting, it's like we did a great episode in the first version where we had a family reunion.
Mm-hmm.
And we brought, like, you know, Oscar's side and Trudy's side, and they had to get together, you know, for Penny's cousin's birthday.
Right.
And we had everybody in the episode, like Anthony Anderson, you know, Cicely Tyson, Monique.
Wow.
Solange even played Penny's cousin. Like, it was voices across the board that you hadn't heard in an
animated
you know, film before or TV show.
Right.
And these guys loved it. They were like, and just getting that sort of amalgamation, that collection of voices together with Cedric and Tommy, and it was like, it was just like a crazy, crazy day getting all that together. But
that's
it worked
incredible.
Perfectly.
Yeah.
You know?
And I want to congratulate you again for Hair Love. I mean, the story is amazing. Like I said, it goes deep down into like what we need to see, especially as a black community. I mean, you've been in the game for a while, and just to see where animation came from and where it's going, you can see like muscles moving, hair blowing. It's just totally different. It's crazy, the digitalization of it, everything.
Yeah, man.
So I want to go into real quick the special segment. So this is fast questions, okay?
Yes.
So I'm going to ask you 5 questions. You give me the first answer that comes to mind.
Uh-oh.
Okay? All right. So what's your favorite word?
Ooh, man. Yes.
Ah, okay. The least favorite word?
It's got to be no.
Mm. What profession, other than your own, would you participate in?
Ooh, I would be a cameraman for NFL films.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
That looks fun.
Okay.
I grew up loving those films growing up.
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay. Your favorite animation that you did not participate in?
Ooh, man. Klaus.
Mm, Klaus.
Yeah, Sergio Pablos, man. They did that movie. It's a mix of hand-drawn and 3D, and it's a proper places.
Uh-huh.
It's not overblown 3D,
right.
And the camera feels, you know, real, and Okay. Sergio knocked that out.
And last but not least, heaven exists. When you get up to God, what would you like him to say to you?
You're such an idiot. But come on in.
Yes. And quick, little, this is like the spotlight that I like to do with my guests at the end of the episode. You go ahead and address the audience there and just leave them with a little something, motivation or inspiration that you like to talk to them.
Oh, yeah. Hey, listen. Hey, you look at a brother who came from the dirt to kind of get to where I am today. Like I said, and I think it's really about, you know, being being steadfast, like, in what you believe in and what you believe is right and what you believe that you can actually give to whatever medium you're participating in, no matter what that job is, no matter who that person is. You really have to believe in yourself. I mean, where I am right now is a collection of people who believe in me, along with me believing in myself. So you got to be able to understand who's in your circle, and make sure that as much as they influence you, you have to be that influencer also. As much as you give, that's what you'll get back. So always think of yourself as that positive person who actually can believe in himself and can get around a lot of people who actually can help you achieve what you need to achieve. You can't do it by yourself, that's for sure. Yeah. I don't profess to do any of this by myself. So it's important to know that it's a village that allows you to be the village idiot.
Hey. And thank you so much. It's a pleasure having you on the show. I relived everything, childhood, and just to get another perspective of animation was amazing. Go ahead and tell everyone where to find you on social media.
Yes, please. Yeah, you can find me at Bruce Almighty. That's with 3 E's on the back. Mm-hmm. On Twitter and on Instagram also. I'm not so active on Instagram yet. I'm waiting for certain things to happen in my world. That's going to happen really soon. Yes. So you'll know exactly why you'd want to follow me on Instagram. So jump right in, follow me now, and then you'll get paid off shortly. Trust me.
Yes. Go ahead. You got a lot coming up. Can't wait to hear about it and see
it. Love to tell you all about it.
And you can find me everywhere at I Am Danny Royce. Thank you for tuning in. We'll see you next week. Same place, same time, inside the Black Actor Studio. Stay blessed.
On behalf of our BHL staff, we would like to thank you for tuning in to Black Hollywood Live, the world's first digital broadcast network devoted entirely to urban entertainment and pop culture. Check out our Black Hollywood Live YouTube page for even more great programming and amazing content. And be sure to subscribe and like our channel when you do. I'm your BHL host, Nakia Monet, and you can find me on all social media at Kiki Boom Boom or at Black Hollywood Live. Black Hollywood Live, Hollywood redefined.